Hello again, I'm Kathleen Dunn, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, the 23rd of November. Richard Wolf is with us this hour. His latest book is Revival, The Struggle for Survival Inside the Obama White House. He's an award-winning journalist, political analyst for MSNBC Television. He covered, and the book really reflects this, the entire length of Barack Obama's presidential campaign for Newsweek magazine, traveled with the candidate and his inner circle from his announcement all the way through Election Day, which was, these are long elections these days, 21 months later. His cover stories for Newsweek included what he believes on Obama's faith, black and white, about Obama and racial politics, Bush in the bubble, about the president after Hurricane Katrina, and Weight of the World, the behind-the-scenes story of how Bush handled the Lebanon War. Before Newsweek, Wolf was a senior journalist at the Financial Times, and we're delighted to have him with us this hour. The book he writes in the intro here is the result of more than 2 months of intensive daily reporting from the White House and several more months of extensive interviews with every senior West Wing official from the president and vice president on down. While Obama's aides did not share their thumb drives, they did share memos, PowerPoints, notes, and many hours of real-time and rear-view observations. We'll be welcoming phone calls and emails for Richard Wolf. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, and our email address is talk@WPR.org. Richard Wolf, hello. Thanks so much for being with us. Oops, I've got... No, he's on ISDN. He's joining us by ISDN from the studios in National Public Radio. Hello, Richard.
Can you hear me now?
I can hear you just fine. Thank you for being with us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me, Kathleen.
I love the way you describe him because it's such an accurate description of the way I see him, too, that this president is an amazingly steady guy.
He is steady, and that's what makes the moments when he gets unsteady all the more revealing and insightful. And, you know, I wanted to sort of choose a month in the life of this White House. It ended up being a couple of months and a very troubled and difficult couple of months they were. But it's a moment when he bounces back from the dead, which is, I guess, what a lot of people look at him now and saying, can he do it again? He did it not that long ago. He did it several times during the campaign. And you see the steadiness being tested in a way that really teaches you much more than the normal flow of politics. It's at times of failure that you really see what people are made of.
I've always wondered, I wonder if you know this about him, was he the kind of student who would just sort of slack off and then at the end write the brilliant paper?
I don't know about the brilliant paper, but yes, he certainly has slacked off in his campaign, in his previous campaigns. And he got this reputation, as I recount in my last book, in Renegade, of being a fourth quarter player, and it drives everyone crazy, his supporters, his donors, his aides, his staffers, everyone. But like a lot of writers, remember, he likes to think of himself as a writer. He needs to be almost past deadline before he really pulls out the work.
That's a good way to think about him, past deadline. Let's talk about those times because I found them pretty moving. I love your description of the inside of the healthcare debate because it was fascinating to find out what was really going on. Most of us had no idea of whether or not he was involved and who he was talking to and Nancy Pelosi. And I want to go into that in depth. But let's start with the end of that. The moments, and I remember the South Carolina campaign when his grandmother had just died, and people were pretty emotionally involved in that campaign, and he cried. And I was thinking about all that came before that moment, what was probably going to come after that moment, who she was in his life, and a guy, and then he did it when the health care bill finally passed. Can you talk about those moments when he showed a little bit of pretty deep emotion?
Right. It's so rare and it's so remarkable. I'm just astonished that people don't really notice it more because everyone was wrapped up in the moment he was signing healthcare and the vice president was going on in his excessive and emotional way about what a great president Obama was. And you'd think the normal response to having Joe Biden gushing would be kind of embarrassment or, you know, you just want to shrink away. And I looked at the president's face and I could see there was this sort of contortion in his cheeks and his neck, and he was struggling to hold back the tears. And that's what was my impression. I checked it out with the people who worked with him, and they said, absolutely it was. And so I checked it out with the president himself in the Oval Office. And what was really striking was that at that moment, he was thinking especially of his mother. And it went a long way to answering a pretty basic and simple question, which was, why was he doing this? Why was he risking his presidency for healthcare? Why did he stick with it over and above the objections of his senior staff? Why did he fight in a way that you hadn't seen him fight for other things and regain some of that campaign spirit? So the character was tested. And, you know, those moments when the facade drops and the public performance ends is really remarkable. We did see it when soon after his grandmother passed away. What struck me at that moment in the campaign was that he mentioned about his grandmother passing. And he was fine in a sense. You know, he delivered the words. His emotion was steady. And then he starts talking about his regular stump speech, about how he's going to change Washington. And that's when he started crying. Mm. You know, he has tremendous self-control, but not always. And so as a writer, as someone who's reported on him for a long time, it's not that I get sort of voyeuristic pleasure from seeing him crack, but I do think you see some of the real character of this guy that he works very hard to keep locked up and out of sight.
Yes, and I wonder why. Why does he keep it locked up and out of sight?
Well, I think he had to pull his own life together. I mean, he actually didn't get raised by his mother, and his father was famously absent. And he was drifting, and he found purpose and discipline in himself, in books, as a student in New York, in a pretty solitary life. And that's worked for him as a politician, that sense of discipline, keeping things in check, being a moderating influence on people around him, synthesizing opinions, setting himself aside. Even as he tells his own story and inspires people with his own story, a lot about himself is set back, is filtered by himself. And so, you know, if the performance has worked, why break it? But that's not to say it's not genuine. It's true. He's not hiding some dark secrets there. But that the real relaxed, more loose Barack Obama, the more emotional Barack Obama, is something you rarely see. And it is at the key to why he has done some of the things he's done.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about the healthcare debate. As I was reminded of the story, I knew it was a deep story, and we covered it. Oh, my gosh, we covered it as you did as well, day by day for a year. What was remarkable about that story is how they'd almost get to the end of it, and then they got to deal with Scott Brown, and they don't have quite the votes, and it is high drama all the way through this incredibly lengthy debate, where at several big points, we're thinking, he's thinking, I'm sure, maybe he isn't thinking, but people around him, that's it, we can't do it.
Right. Well, a lot of everyone in Washington, frankly, said that at the moment I pick up this narrative, this month turns out in 2 months in the life of this White House, everyone says the presidency's finished and healthcare is dead and there's no chance of it to go on, which is kind of a bit like the situation we're in now. And 2 months later, at the end of my narrative, my time that I was that I embedded myself in this White House, healthcare is done. This president's on track to reclaim some of that campaign spirit. Revival is not just about, as the title of the book, it's not just about how healthcare was revived, but it's also about the revival of this campaign spirit and identity that in many ways the first year or two has taken him away from. So, you know, they were clinging on through the healthcare debate. They thought, we just get through this month, we get through this week, we'll get another vote and we'll be there. And in fact, the longer they clung on, the more in a rut they got about doing business in the old Washington way, doing deals, sweetheart deals for senators and members of various industry interest groups. And the only way they broke out of it was to go out and campaign, was to take it outside Washington, call out the insurers and actually tell stories of people like his mother. I mean, his mother wasn't just important because it was an emotional thing. It was important because this was a real life experience of many people, sadly, dealing with terrible illnesses like cancer and struggling and fighting with their insurance companies along the way. That kind of real world story was what pulled him over the top in a way that doing a deal with Ben Nelson in Nebraska just didn't.
Yeah, like the story that he carried on with Laura Klitschka from Green Bay, who had breast cancer, and you tell her story, and he brings up her story several times, and she's had a State of the Union speech, isn't she?
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. And she is incredibly powerful for him. She becomes a sort of a talisman because every time his senior advisors say, just give it up, he basically cites Laura Klitschka. And Laura's story actually echoes his own mother's story in many ways. Mm-hmm. So the characters that he pulls up are not dissimilar to his mother, and I think that's very striking. Again, when people say this stuff is hurting you, and he says, I'm out there doing it for Laura, or when they say we need to make this change, he goes, how does this affect someone like Laura? And those personal things, those personal stories, both were helpful publicly in terms of humanizing what he was out there trying to do and who he was trying to work for, but it's also important internally, privately, because it sustains him at a time when his White House was really divided. Why was he putting all his chips on healthcare? And the answer comes back to people like Laura and his mother.
Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about Nancy Pelosi, who I find extremely interesting as a leader. I think she's a very, very powerful leader, one of the history's most powerful speakers of the House. But I've always wondered, and I'm so glad you wrote about the relationship between Pelosi and Obama. And you're saying in the book, I don't think that Nancy is difficult to negotiate with at all. She's very mindful of her caucus. She let him know on several occasions exactly what she thought of what right. was going on. And he also did this storming out of a room, too. Can you talk about that and their relationship?
I think it is fascinating. You know, I don't want people to listen to this and think this is a book about healthcare. It's really about these people struggling with these giant issues under intense pressure. And
right.
so Nancy Pelosi, as you say, an incredibly strong leader who personally I don't think has got nearly the attention she deserves being the first woman Speaker of the House. But that's a side point. She was incredibly tough to negotiate with, very frustrating for the president and the White House. In some ways, in many ways, dragged out negotiations because she was fighting so hard for her caucus, for her interest groups, dragged it out to the point where, you know, this is just a few days before Massachusetts. The president is trying to get House Democrats and the Senate Democrats to agree to close the gap between them, especially in terms of money, on how much health care reform is going to cost. And he has them in the White House. The negotiations are dragging on. The Senate Democrats say, okay, we'll halve the difference. We'll split the difference. And Nancy Pelosi says, no, I'm not going to split the difference. I'm exactly where I am. My offer is my offer, and I'm not moving. And the Senate Democrats halve the difference again. And she says, I'm still not moving. This is my offer. I'm not changing. This drags on for several hours. It actually had been dragging on for several weeks and several days. But it drags on for several hours in the White House. And ultimately, the president, he goes off to his daughter's music recital, comes back. They're still messing around. They're still not being able to budge Nancy Pelosi. And he storms out. He says, that's it. I'm going to bed. Rahm, you figure it out. We are so close to a historic change, and you're arguing about a few million dollars. I've had it. I'm done. And it works. And all the people in the room are shocked. They're shocked. They have never seen the president do this kind of thing. It's another emotional outburst. So I go to the president and said, what was up with that? Were you really angry? He says, oh, no, that was all fake. I did that just to shock them. And it worked. You know, 2 hours later, they got the deal done. The irony is, apart from the sort of theater of this, the irony is that had they come to this agreement earlier, just a day earlier, in the president's view, they could have done all of this, had it all done, out to vote again, before they lost in Massachusetts. That would have saved them a lot of grief and a lot of political capital. Mm-hmm. So he says he told me anyway, he enjoys negotiating with Nancy Pelosi. I think it might be a bit more complicated than that.
I think so, too. That's a wonderful story. What does he hold? It's because we don't have a full sense of what his soul is like. Tell me, I found these bits interesting of the fact that he has the Emancipation Proclamation, I believe, in the Oval Office.
Yeah.
That what are the things that surround him that he holds dear?
Yeah, you know, a lot of conservatives didn't like this, but he replaced Winston Churchill's bust in the Oval Office that President Bush had put in there with a bust of Martin Luther King. And he has this sort of mini shrine, I don't know, of King and Lincoln. He has an original copy of the a sort of flyer for the march on Washington for jobs. Obviously, the King's moment of "I Have a Dream." He has that, and the Emancipation Proclamation, and King and Lincoln really dominate the Oval Office as he set it up. And you can understand why. I mean, he doesn't talk about it publicly a lot, but it is extremely important for him. And as I recount in both books, in Revival and my last book, in Renegade, when he was considering whether or not to run for president, one of his best friends said to him, you know, you get elected, this is going to be the biggest thing in this country for African Americans since the Emancipation Proclamation. And at the time, I mean, this guy's, you know, a freshman senator and barely out of the Illinois State Senate. It sounds ridiculous. But of course, as we saw from a million people on the Mall, this was a huge and historic moment in time for America. And he's more than conscious of that. He just doesn't make it a central part of his politics. And I think quite rightly, too. It's obvious.
Right. It is a huge thing, isn't it? When you sit back and remember that, and you were there for all of those months, I envy you that, to see how it all happened. That it was an incredible event to have happen in this country, Richard, wasn't it?
It was an incredible event, an incredible journey. I think I have the gray hairs to prove this. Yes, there were wonderful moments, but this was also not a sort of straight trajectory into orbit. There have been many moments in the presidency, as I explain in Revival, but also during the campaign when things were bad, when he looked like he wasn't going to make it. He struggled for the first year of his campaign. He lost in New Hampshire. It was a flash in the pan. He couldn't close the deal after Texas and Ohio and Pennsylvania. And then when Sarah Palin was nominated, everyone panicked and said he was emasculated somehow. So, you know, you look at healthcare and the presidency being over, you look at the election now and people saying he's finished. And you've got to think back to those moments as well as the highs for his supporters, whether it was the inauguration or election night. Because the real test of this guy, the real reason he made it, was because he toughed out those low moments. It wasn't because he went from one high to another. It's just never been like that.
Mm-hmm. Richard Wolff, our guest this hour, and we're going to be taking your phone calls. His book is Revival, The Struggle for Survival Inside the Obama White House. And we welcome your thoughts. It's fascinating. It deals with... although he brings to this the information that he gathered because he covered the whole campaign, the Obama campaign, and, you know, the inauguration and all of that. So his eye has been on that. So that informs this particular book. But it covers January through March, very specifically 2010. And he interviewed so many people were involved with all the decision-making, real behind the scenes, and it gives you a much deeper understanding of how this White House functions. Here's our phone number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, and our email address is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to phone calls for Richard now, and let's start with Rich in Sullivan. Hi, Rich.
Hi, good morning, Kathy.
Hi.
Good morning,
Jeff.
Good morning. It really saddens me that Barack Obama seems to me to be one of the brightest people we've ever had in the Oval Office. The only other person who comes to mind immediately, although I wasn't his supporter, was Richard Nixon. I thought he was an extremely well-read and bright individual. However, like Richard Nixon in some ways, Barack Obama makes me believe in the concept of emotional intelligence, because I've been tracking this campaign Sarah Palin is on, and I've been watching Barack Obama carefully and thinking about Bill Clinton and the business of I feel your pain and all that sort of thing. And I think that these midterm elections has convinced me that when we have a sense that the other person just doesn't get it, it indicates some degree of energetic contraction and disconnection from other people. I think that's what Barack Obama, in public, on the public political stage, is communicating to a lot of middle-class voters, that he's governing like an administrator who manages some department or division of something, and he just, with liberals, he's not angry enough. With conservatives, he's not funny and relaxed enough. He just seems compressed into this character of a person who, unlike Ronald Reagan, whom I didn't think was a particularly bright man, but who I thought deserved the title of the great communicator, I don't think when Barack Obama is not making a speech that he's doing a good job of connecting to the American people.
Hmm. Interesting comment, Rich. Richard?
I think that is an interesting perspective. I haven't heard the Nixon comparison before, but one of the debates, in fact, the central debate that I recount in Revival is about how the president has become. Has grown adrift from his campaign identity. And I describe there being two camps. One group I call the revivalists, who want to revive the campaign spirit, and the survivalists, who want to play the inside Washington game. And the inside Washington game, I think, is what the caller is really referring to.
Mm-hmm.
If you are just managing the bureaucracy or looking for votes and concentrating on the legislative process, then you are not the change, reform, transparent guy you were in 2008. That has been the central fault line in this White House, an open point of dispute on a whole range of things, whether it was healthcare or the economy. And it's very hard to connect and communicate if you have got an unresolved position about whether you're playing an inside game or an outside game. And to the extent that they have turned things around on healthcare to get that vote through, to the extent that they're trying to change things now, a lot of it is tilted back towards the campaign spirit. Show him in a different environment, talking directly to the American people, appealing to independent voters who've drifted away from him, and above all, get back to this sense of trying to do things differently in Washington, of saying there's too many gimmicks going on there, there are too many political games being played with really serious things. So yes, this president has a foot in both camps. He wants to be the inside Washington guy and the outside Washington guy. But when you see some of the campaign people coming back into the White House, people like David Plouffe, who we learned just today,
right,
who ran the campaign, is going to be coming back to the White House sooner than expected, I think you're going to see more of this approach of saying this system is broken and the guy to change it is President Obama, because that's who he was in 2008, and now he's president, he can actually do something about it.
So when you talk in the book about his straddling both groups, thus leaving the questions about his character and purpose unresolved, are you saying that he needs to align himself more with the revivalist or the survivalist
yes.
group?
Yeah, I think, look, to some extent you have to campaign and govern. But for the first 2 years, essentially they said, we're not doing this campaigning thing anymore. And they did that at a time when the Republicans actually accelerated and intensified their campaign. And they were slow to wake up to that fact. So concentrating on governing right now is just not going to work. It's not going to work because you cannot narrow cast your message to a handful of Republicans. It's not even clear that there are a handful of Republican votes that he can get on any subject.
Right.
Look at how they've struggled to get this nuclear treaty through when you have people like Henry Kissinger. Talk about Nixon. You have Henry Kissinger out there saying that they should get a nuclear treaty through, and yet Republicans say, essentially, we don't want to give Barack Obama anything.
Yeah, it seems like such a given to have the nuclear treaty signed, doesn't it?
Right. Well, when you're talking about inspecting Russian nuclear missiles and facilities, you would think that Republicans and Democrats can agree that's a good thing.
Right.
That's where we are right now. And that means that the campaign is here. It's now. And if he's going to campaign, then he has to campaign in the model of 2008, which is to say, enough with the games. Let's be grown up here, because there are very serious issues this country has to face, whether it's at war or it's about deficits. And by the way, not only is that who he is, but that's the successful approach that he had, especially with these independent voters who swung by him in 2008 and have turned against him, or at least against Democrats in 2010.
To say nothing of the fact that the country needs it, right?
Well, if you're going to deal with deficits, if you're going to deal with a still struggling economy and this very complicated war and terrorist threats, yes, these are not small issues that we have, and they are issues that affect us all. So you can play politics with TSA screenings, you can play politics with nuclear treaties, but they are real issues. These are not concocted things, no matter what the games look like.
And now today you've got North Korea.
And North Korea, too. You know, every time we see one of these crises, people do sort of sit up in their seats and say, oh, wait a second, this isn't actually just a game being played out on cable TV.
Yeah, exactly. How demoralized, or maybe he wasn't, do you have any sense of, or is he holding everything so close to the chest that we don't see this, by the midterm elections? Was he real down about it?
Yeah, he was really down about it. And actually, to the point where many of his aides were really kind of struck by wanting him to get out of this funk. But he was also very down in January, in this period that I describe in Revival, where to the point where, you know, he was telling his aides that his wife was giving him a very hard time, that she didn't like his message, and that he was messing up, and that and he seemed very down. You don't often see that in public, but he feels it. He expresses it to those around him. Again, it happened time and time again. Remember that whole fired up, ready to go story that he would tell through the campaign? That was a story, yes, about him being fired up, but it was a story about him being down. Nothing was going right in the campaign. Bad stories in the New York Times. He got rained on. He drove for hours to some small town when there was no one there except for this woman saying, fired up, ready to go. And it became his rallying cry precisely because it got him out of his gloom. And that's the pattern people have to remember. That's the story, the essential story I'm telling in this book.
Yeah. Rich, thanks for your call a while ago. And we'll give the phone number again, 800-486-8655. Richard Wolff is our guest this hour. His new book is Revival, The Struggle for Survival Inside the Obama White House. And the email address, talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. Scott from La Crosse. Hello, Scott.
Hello, Kathleen.
Hi, Scott.
I'm loving the whole morning. Both your hours have been great.
Thank you.
And this gentleman, very, very good. Thank you. Sir, I got a question for you. You remember the article, opinion piece, whatever, that came out encouraging the president to say, hey, I'm a one-term guy.
yes.
Let's get these things done. Here's your chance to work with me or not, and see what the Republicans would do. I'm pretty convinced that Mitch and the gang think that gridlock is working for them, and I think this New START treaty is as clear a sign of that as I can imagine. So, that being the circumstance, what do you think? Do you think he would actually consider something like that? And when that opinion piece came out, the thing that occurred to me is, if he were to make that kind of a decision and say, I am a one-term president, but if you folks are thinking of somebody who might be good in 2012, my Secretary of State has been great.
Well, is he considering it? No, he's not considering it. It's an interesting thing you raise, Secretary Clinton, who has done a great job at the State Department, but that opinion piece was written by a guy who is a Democrat pollster, very close to Hillary Clinton's chief strategist in her campaign. So there are a number of Clinton people, I'm not saying Hillary Clinton, but a number of Clinton people who still harbor these ambitions and hopes that they can return to the political presidential scene. And I find, as I describe in Revival, you know, a lot of this stuff is quite petty and childish because they haven't really gotten over the primaries in 2008. And really, they're all in the same administration. It's kind of baffling that they want to continue with that fight. Does this president think of himself as a one-termer? Well, he goes around saying he'd rather be a one-termer and do big things than be a two-termer and do small things. He's kind of looking at the Clinton model there, the Bill Clinton model, but he's so competitive. I believe he wants to do big things and be a two-termer.
Do you think that there's a possibility that, I mean, when you said this system is broken, that he could, though, look at the gridlock of two more years, and if he were to get reelected and the Republicans, my guess is he would never get to have enough momentum built up to get the kind of, as they say, veto-proof majority to get things done. I mean, is this really eating at him, this kind of, it would be eating at me if I were in his position. Fortunately, I will never be, but you know what I'm saying, that this has got to be just a terrible thing for people who are in that office wanting to get something accomplished.
It's incredibly frustrating that you can win an election in a very clear and decisive way, have big majorities in both sides of Congress, and still be frustrated because you don't have 60 votes on every subject. Yes, he's found that extremely frustrating, but I think there's every reason, if you look at the history of presidents in their second terms, if he wins re-election, there is a small window for a second honeymoon. It's not as long as the first honeymoon, but you can get big things done in that time when people are reassessing and looking at where their own political futures seem to be. So there's a hope, and as I describe in Revival, one of those things he really, really wants to address, which his former chief of staff, Rahm Emanuel, thought was political malpractice, he wants to go back to immigration reform.
Yes.
And
there's a nice, easy issue.
right. And I would not be surprised for him to open up that debate now and say, I get reelected, this is the one big thing I want to do in that second honeymoon that I expect to have.
Well, let's talk about what the American people, if we are to believe the midterm elections, and I guess we have to, we're telling him what they want him to do, and that's to do something about the economy and do something about jobless rate and unemployment rate. Can you describe, please, and you do in the book, a little bit more about why he selected Tim Geithner and Larry Summers, if he indeed was off base with getting people who were too close to Wall Street, what the relationship was among Summers and Geithner and people in the administration and the president, and why whatever they worked out just hasn't worked well enough.
Yeah, you know, it's a really fascinating story that I retell in Revival, which is how these two guys came to have the jobs they've got, Geithner and Summers. Remember, they were both Clinton people. There was a feeling, of course, at the time of the financial meltdown when the general election took place and the transition was happening, there was a feeling inside Obama's camp that they needed to reassure the market. So rather than saying we want to be away from Wall Street, remember, it was a deep crisis. Nobody knew where the bottom was, were how many banks would close, how many major institutions would collapse. You kind of have to make a mental effort to recall what that felt like, because Citibank could have gone under, Bank of America could have gone under. This was going to have a giant impact, even more than we saw, had it continued. So they wanted to send out a reassuring signal. Tim Geithner, they actually thought that Larry Summers would be a better fit in the Treasury Department, because he had been Treasury Secretary before. But Tim Geithner, who everyone thought was maybe an easier character and more of a younger figure to his previous mentor, Larry Summers, Tim Geithner would step aside and let Summers take this on. But as I recount, he played hardball. He said, if I don't get the job of Treasury Secretary, I'm staying in the New York Fed. So forget it. You want me there, you give me the big job. So that's how he won it. Larry Summers, to be fair, told the president, in his own words, he told me that he told the president that he wasn't a good manager. If he wanted a good manager, he should choose someone else. And in fact, that's proven to be true. He has been a terrible manager. The economic team has been, as I say, one of the most, if not the most, dysfunctional teams inside the White House.
My.
Most of those people are on their way out, if they haven't already gone. And just a lot of distrust, a lot of disagreement, and a lot of that comes from Summers, who is an obstructionist character. He's a contrarian. He's kind of academic contrarian. And this has caused them no end of problems, not because they haven't had an economic policy, they have, but in talking about things, in coming up with new solutions, whether it's for small businesses or lending, it's been extremely difficult because this team has not worked well together.
So how is that going to turn around?
Well, he's got new people in. We're seeing a whole bunch of changes. Larry Summers is out. Tim Geithner is really the only survivor. A lot of people under Summers are moving out as well. We just found out in the last day or so. You know, they have to be able to talk about what they've done and come up with new initiatives in a much smoother, cleaner, more nimble way. And obviously, the economy has to pick up. But we're seeing that already in train. I mean, just today, there's news that the corporations have had their most profitable quarter ever in American history. The stock market has recovered pretty much all of its losses from the peak of the crisis, or the depths of the crisis, before the presidential election. And, you know, you're looking at an economy that while unemployment is still stubbornly high, is certainly gathering pace. It's very frustrating for everyone, but the trend line is pretty clear.
Yeah, but you got to put people back to work.
You do. You do, and corporations are making so much profits because they're not putting people back to work, and they're still getting profits squeezed out of their current workforce. Why corporations are not spending their money, they're sitting on giant piles of cash, it comes down to confidence, and confidence needs time. There's nothing, you know, it's not as if the Republicans say we need less government and less regulation. The crash didn't happen because there was too much government and too much regulation. So this political debate is really independent of what's going on inside the sort of inside the mentality and the psychology of these boards, and after the kind of shock to the system, if you see your banks pulling back credit lines and you're worried that the stock market is going to completely collapse, then it's not surprising that it takes time for companies to go out and hire and buy new equipment, but they're going to do it. It's just that they don't operate just to sit on piles of cash.
Richard Wolff, our guest, his new book, Revival, The Struggle for Survival Inside the Obama White House. Richard, of course, an award-winning journalist and political analyst for MSNBC. He covered the whole length of President Obama's presidential campaign for Newsweek magazine, and also before that was senior journalist at the Financial Times. Here is our phone number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email address is talk@WPR.org. This is the, and Scott, thanks for the call. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Returning to your phone calls, Todd in Winona, Minnesota. Hi, Todd.
Hi, how are you doing?
Fine, how are you?
Good, and here's, this is, I guess, probably a question, but mostly an hypothesis, and I just want to get your guest reaction. I don't think that the election we just experienced had anything to do with Obama's accomplishments or lack of them. They were entirely the result of a strategy by the Republicans, and it was a successful one. And my lesson from it was be intensely partisan, distort the record of your own party as well as the other candidates, and just go for broke, regardless of the interest of the nation is irrelevant. What you want to do is win. I mean, that for me is a take-home message, and that's what I would say to President Obama and Democrats. I would say, forget trying to be conciliatory, work across the aisle. Forget it. That's not going to get you wins in the next election. What you want to do is make the other party look as bad as possible, make you look as good as possible, period, independent of any factual reality.
Richard, what do you think?
Well, if the election was all about one base versus the other, then that would make a lot of sense. But the big shift in this election in 2010 was among independent voters. And there is a, you know, they supported him in 2008. They drifted away from him through the last couple of years. He's got to win them back if he wants to win back the presidency. And there's one point of interest, I think, between independents and Democrats, which is similar, which is that they both want compromise. They both like to see the parties working together. Independents, certainly. That's why they're independent. They don't like the partisan divide. So you have to look reasonable. How you define working with the other side is up to you. This is where the politics and campaigning kicks in. You know, they've defined it until now, really, in terms of winning a few Republicans in Congress. That isn't the goal. It never was the real test of whether you're reaching across party lines. There are lots of Republican governors they've worked with. There are lots of Republican ideas that have become part and parcel of the Obama agenda, not least of which was on health care. This was essentially a Republican bill, whether it was Mitt Romney's Massachusetts health care or Chuck Grassley's approach after the Clinton efforts in the early 90s, it was a private sector approach. So explaining that to people, looking reasonable, reaching out to the other side, that's what independents want to see. Now, if Republicans turn their back on that, then they're going to lose independent voters too. But you cannot define reaching out as winning a handful of Republican votes, because we all know the White House now knows to its pain and cost that getting a couple of Republican votes either doesn't happen or is just too painful.
And the independents that the administration lost voted Republican because?
Because they are concerned about the economy, they're concerned about the deficits, they're concerned about the tone of Washington and the lack of transparency. Those are the kinds of things that independents really value in ways that other voting groups don't. So the deficit debate we're about to get into here and have started getting into in Washington really tests that proposition to breaking point. If Republicans are true to their rhetoric, which they have used to win over independent voters, among other things, if they say that deficits are really what troubles them, then they have to be prepared to deal with everything. And that includes not just spending, but revenues, taxes as well. And what we're seeing is Republicans saying, well, we'll deal with everything but taxes. That's a chance for this president to say, you're not serious. You're just not serious about deficits. And independent voters will hear that, because everyone who is grown up and serious about politics will know that you have to deal with both sides. Not just, you know, it's true in your household, it's true everywhere else. You want to balance things, you have to deal with what you bring in as well as what you spend.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Todd, for the call. Here's an email from Karen Richard. Is David Plouffe going to be the game changer for messaging? I'm hoping, she says.
Well, Plouffe had a strategic discipline in the campaign that took in messaging as well as ground operations. And, you know, he cannot do everything himself, but he's a signal that the president wants to move in that direction, especially as they go into 2 years of campaigning for the next presidential cycle. Obviously, the Republicans are already running. They don't have the luxury of sitting back in the Oval Office for a year, as even President Bush could do in 2003, 2004. The campaign is right here and now, and Plouffe is singularly focused on reaching out to independent voters, on being disciplined about signaling change. That is his mantra. And one thing they didn't really have under Rahm Emanuel was that kind of strategic discipline.
Mark in Appleton. Hi, Mark.
Thank you. I think one of the fundamental problems with the Obama administration is that they have not been able to expose the corporate interests that are really behind the government nowadays. I mean, we basically have the best form of government that corporate money can buy. And you can see that clearly with the opposition to the health care reform, also to this opposition to the nuclear treaty. It's not profitable for the defense industry if you don't have a war or a potential war, because there's no reason for or budget for to buy weapons. So I think there's a big, huge failure in ripping the mask off and exposing people for what they really are. And the Republican Party, who is actually the party of the 1%, who is representing all these corporate interests, they're funded, owned, and operated by them. And the failure of doing so in a very clear and concise manner, I think, has been a detriment to this particular organization.
Yeah, you know, that's a good point. They tried it late in this last campaign, and they need to sustain that because it is corporations are spending large amounts of money. Rich individuals are spending large amounts of money, often through these shadowy groups or hiding behind, say, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. It's something that troubles people, especially those independent voters we've been speaking about. On the other hand, it's not going to stop because you talk about it, because what we've seen from the most recent Supreme Court decisions is that this is just how the next election is going to play itself out. So I think it's going to be very interesting seeing Republicans in the House especially, and how they interact with lobbyists, how they interact with corporate interests. Democrats really need to explain that to people. It's not going to be obvious. None of this stuff is obvious. That's what campaigning is about. You have to show people who wanted change, who voted for change, whether they're Tea Party folks or independent voters or Democrats, that it's back to business as usual for Republicans. And that's their only opening that they can use a lot of voters, if you look at the polls, think that Republicans have changed because they got this whole new brand in with the Tea Party. They don't believe that the Republicans' economic proposals are essentially unchanged. And again, this is a job for Democrats and for the White House in particular to say it's the same old, same old. This promise of change wasn't actually genuine.
Yeah. Here's an email from Gene from Wauwatosa who says, thanks for your guest, Richard Wolff. Thank you, Richard. My comment is, Obama seems professional, and this is irritating to the Republicans. His martial arts strategy and Zen timing proves he's the right person for these times. The sun came out when he took the stage at the rally in Madison, and he's had timing like that since he started running. Unfortunately, he needs a TV network that makes enough noise and wacky spins, perhaps more 60 Minutes appearances?
Well, you can't say he's been shy about appearing on TV. You know, that the Madison rally was extremely impressive. But one of the troubling things for this White House is essentially losing Wisconsin, losing the upper Midwest.
They lost Wisconsin big time.
Yeah, and they've got to win that back. They cannot afford that to be even close if they're going to be competitive in 2012. So, you know, as you know better than I do, a lot of that comes down to the economy. It comes down to people wanting change and getting back to that spirit in 2008, because Wisconsin was not close in 2008, as I recall.
Right. Dave in Menominee, Michigan. Hi, Dave.
Hi. Good morning. Thanks, Richard. Enjoyed Renegade, and I look forward to your new book.
Thank you.
Another thing I wanted to bring up is that the White House and Democrats are unable to communicate accomplishments, what they have done, what they've actually been able to do. When it came time, when elections came, it seemed that you know, the message had been spun so well, the accomplishments were turned into negatives by the Republicans. So, you know, they were very good at it, and I wanted to get your thoughts on have they been talking about how they're going to try to, you know, counter this? Is David Plouffe right. going to make a difference?
Yeah, this is something I explore at length in Revival, which is, you know, there was a feeling inside the White House that their accomplishments were obvious, and they're not. These are complicated issues. I recount how Joe Biden told me, the vice president who's tasked with selling the Recovery Act and managing it, how he felt that they had not talked about it in the right way. Talking about it in terms of jobs saved or created was not the right way, that they needed to talk much more about saving people from the abyss, whether it was through unemployment benefits or COBRA. You know, some of his advisors, some of the president's advisors said that they would have done better had they broken up the Recovery Act into its component pieces so people could understand it better. But talking about accomplishments and the record is something they have singularly failed to do. Again, when they recover their mojo, when they revive themselves and get back to a campaign spirit, it's precisely because they're able to distill the debate in ways that they have not done so before. They did it on healthcare, they did it through the campaign, and now's the time to talk about the recovery and what they did with the Recovery Act in a much more clear way. And maybe Plouffe will be part of that. Maybe it'll be new initiatives that come out of the economic team, but they are spending a lot of time trying to figure out how to talk about that. They desperately need it.
Thank you, Dave, very much. And let's take just one really quick call. We're almost out of time, but Mike, you can say this.
Obama was oversold by the media, including this station. It was more like a pep rally when he won, but many people didn't vote for Obama. They just voted against the last administration. So when you made all these ridiculous assumptions, like he's going to save the world, the black messiah or whatever, then all of a sudden people's hopes are shattered, and naturally they're going to turn away from that.
Richard.
I don't know who said he was going to save the world. I mean, there's quite a lot to do there.
Yes, there is.
expectations are interesting. You know, I hear a number of people on the left who say that the president's been a disappointment because he didn't end the war in Afghanistan. Well, he never said he was going to do that. Or he didn't come up with a public option on healthcare. He never said he was going to do that either. There's a myth that built up that didn't have much to do with reality, just as people on the right now have this myth that he's a socialist, communist, whatever they call him, and that's just as ridiculous, if not more so. In this world where you can go on the internet and find out just exactly what you want to hear, then maybe you can find an echo of your deepest thoughts, but that doesn't mean to say that it's true. It never was true, and I'd be surprised if people on this station said he was going to save the world.
No, I don't remember saying that. Richard, thank you so much. It was a wonderful hour. Have a great Thanksgiving.
Thank you. Thank you for having me, and happy Thanksgiving to everyone.
Richard Wolff, the book is Revival, The Struggle for Survival Inside the Obama White House. My family is starting to come in tonight from various locations, and so I will be gone now for the next few days cooking, and we'll be with you again on Monday.